Thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over to Derek.
This is actually a performance art piece about humans and technology. So thank you very much, Kanye. The plan for the evening is to, I was asked a series of questions, and so I wrote up some responses, and then I would like to just, basically that would be the plan, is to talk about, answer the questions that were asked of me. So the first question is, please explain ecofeminism. How does this philosophy relate to a return to a simpler way of life? And for that, what I want to talk about is, a couple years ago, I became friends with Eve Ensler. Do you know who she is? And the way we became friends is that we've always liked each other's work. And it's very interesting, actually. We've liked about 95% of each other's work. And I think that's a really important thing, because there are a great number of writers with whom I disagree with some of their work. And I think it's really important. I'll back up a little bit. In about 1995 or so, Ward Churchill wrote an essay completely slamming gerrymandering. And I asked my friend Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist, what she thought about Ward Churchill's essay. And she said, well, what Ward should have done is write his own damn book. And I've really taken that to heart, that in maybe 1995 or 96, I perceived what I thought was a huge hole in environmental discourse that we'll get to in a while. And so what I did is I attempted to fill that hole. And oh my gosh, you're already seeing why my books are written in a nonlinear fashion, because I can't stand talking about that. People ask me all the time, what should we do? And I always say, I don't know who you are, so I don't know what you should do. I'm not supposed to know what I'm supposed to do. And there are some questions that really inform my own work, and questions that I then give to the people asking, what should I do? And one of the questions is, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you in all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help us solve using the gifts that we need to in all the universe? And part of that has to do with, well, people have said to me, gosh, Derek, you've written all these books, why don't you stop and become an organizer? And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, I mean, I can't even organize my pens. And also, I'm a dreadful introvert. Dreadful, is that the right word? Extreme. We shouldn't put a slur against being an introvert. I'm a horrible introvert. Not actually a very good introvert. So one evening I was back in the 90s, I was working with this environmental organization called the Public Lands Council. And they had this thing where they were doing a phone tree, and we're supposed to call people within the organization and ask them to come to something, I don't know what. And I spent the entire evening dialing 6 numbers out of people's phone numbers, and I couldn't do the last one because I couldn't cold call. I was completely freaking out. And other people are dialing a person every 20 seconds. I can't do it. And another time we were doing a door hanging, and everybody in the organization except me was really doing it. And what I was doing is walking down the sidewalk, and then whenever it would come time to, for somebody to put something on somebody's doorknob, they didn't have to talk to them. I would stand there on the sidewalk and say, okay, you can go take that up. Because it was terrifying to go up to somebody's house. And so what are the gifts that you have? I mean, I have something of a gift for writing, and something of a gift for speaking, and I don't have a gift for organizing. And so that's a question to ask yourself. What are your gifts, and how can you... And the next question is, how can you use these gifts in the service of your land base? And another question is, what do you love? Because chances are good that, I mean, you love something, and if you love something, it's probably under assault. And, you know, I've written a lot about salmon, how much I love salmon, and I often think that if I grew up in the Great, well, I did actually grow up in Colorado, but if I live now in the Great Plains, prairie dogs, you know, they're so fucking cute. And if I lived in the Great Plains, I would love prairie dogs, and I would write about prairie dogs the same way. And so what do you love, you know? You must love something. And then the next question is, you know, what do you love is kind of, I don't know, that's kind of a bit much. I also like to ask, what do you get off on? And the reason I like that better than what do you love, because what do you love is like, oh, I love walks on the beach and staring into the fire. And it's like a really personal thing. And on the other hand, what do you get off on is it's just a bit more earthy. I remember we're trying to stop these developers. I mean, don't you love the language? That's the thing is, if they can control language, then they can control the whole discourse. And a developer, I mean, a child develops into an adult, a caterpillar develops into a butterfly, and a meadow does not develop into white box houses, you know? And they're killers, what they are. And anyway, this killer was trying to destroy the forest near where I live, and we were trying to stop him. Actually, I was working with Sharon Duggan on this. And I was out one day working with this wetland specialist, and what he did was he dug into the soil, then he would rub the soil between his fingertips, and he would then determine whether the soils were wetland soils. He would compare the color to a chart, and if they are a certain color, then it's wetlands and there's more protection. And I'm watching this guy dig out of the soil and do this, and I say, do you get off on doing this? He's like, oh, yeah. That's my second favorite thing to do after playing with my dogs. And I said, you know, this is really great because I would hate this. On the other hand, I completely get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I have condemned myself to a life of homework. But I completely get off on it, you know? And so find the thing you get off on, and find what you love that's under assault, and then use the thing that you get off on to stop the assaults on the things you love. And there, you've solved all the problems. Anyway, so Eve Ensler asked me to write this piece. She was going to do a piece that was going to be the male equivalent of the Vagina Monologues, and it was going to be called The Man Box. And it's about what the box that you're put into if you're a man, and how you can get out of it. And it's actually pretty funny because the reason that you haven't seen this developed is that she couldn't get enough good entries, which I think is just tremendously funny, but we'll leave that aside. Okay, so anyway, this is what I wrote for. It ended up being one of the best things I've ever written. I'm really happy with it. So this is The Man Box. And this is sort of my statement on ecofeminism too. The man box is full of proof. Except that there is no man box, the man box can never be filled, and real men don't need proof. Let's start with Abraham and Isaac. You know the story. God tells Abraham to slit his child's throat. Abraham ties up his son, raises the knife, and at the last moment God says it was a test. End of story. Lesson? Abraham shows, by his willingness to violate his child, the proof of his worth. And Isaac learns that his father was willing to kill him rather than act against the cult of masculinity, against the rules of the man box. There are many rules of the man box, even though there is no man box, and there are no rules. Why call it a box when it's the way things are? And why call it a rule when it's who you are? Rule 1, there is no man box. Rule 2, there is no box but the man box, and thou shalt have no other boxes before it. Rule 3, that's the way things are. rule four. That's who you are. So I'm in a restaurant. I overhear one guy say to another that he's in pain. The other responds, suck it up. When are you going to quit being such a woman? So yeah, I understand that men are taught to not feel. Yeah, I understand that the cult of masculinity is all about not feeling. I understand that must be hard. But honestly, I don't give a shit about understanding the emotional states of the members of the cult of masculinity, except insofar as that understanding might help stop them. It's a bit late in the game to be worried about the feelings of perpetrators. The ones I care about are the victims. Because the man box isn't about putting men in a box. It's about putting everyone else in a box. The box of other. The box of less than. Of trophies. The box of the violable. The box of targets. The box of victims. The box of the violated. The box of proof of the man's own manhood. You ever done the math on how many women who are alive right now have been raped? It's about 7 billion people on the planet. So about 3.5 billion women. About 1 in 4 women is raped in a lifetime. Another 1 in 5 end up rape attempts. So more than 800 million women living today will be raped in their lifetimes. Let's say half of those have not yet been raped. So 400 million women living right now have been raped. Which, by the way, that's one of the disagreements I have with Eve Benthor. She thinks the number is about a billion. Another now, another now. This also means, among many other things, unless a few men are excruciatingly busy, there's a lot of rapists out there. A lot of members of the cult of masculinity. A lot of men who adhere to the rules of the man box. We already knew that. But of course there is no man box. There can be no man box. Because if there were a man box, that would mean there's something outside the man box. And there's nothing outside the man box because there can be nothing outside the man box. And there can be nothing outside the man box because there must be nothing outside the man box. Because if there were, well, there isn't. And can't be. And mustn't be. Because if there were, that would be members of the cult of masculinity aren't as omnipotent, as completely potent as they must be. And also because if there were, why would any victims put up with this shit? So there must not be a man box because everything's part of the man box. That is, everything is violable. And everything must be violated. Rule 5, which is actually rule 1, which is actually the only rule there is, I exist only insofar as I violate you. But of course rule 5 doesn't exist, nor does rule 1. The other day I saw an astronomer saying why he thought it was important to explore Mars and other planets. It will, he said, answer that most important question of all. Are we all alone? I have an even more important question. Is he fucking crazy? No, just a member of the cult of masculinity. Did you know that 200 years ago there were flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days at a time? And flocks of Eskimo curlews so thick that 10 or 15 or 20 birds would fall to a single shot? There's so many whales in the North Atlantic they were a hazard to shipping. And I've read accounts off of Cape Cod where the whales were so thick that it looked like it was always foggy. There were runs of salmon so thick that they would keep you awake all night with the slapping of their tails against the water. And he asks if we're all alone. Only if you're a member of the cult of masculinity. In which case you are, of course, alone with other members of your cult. Because you've declared yourself to be the only one who matters. The one who does too, as opposed to everyone else to whom it is done. Did you know that this culture is driving 200 species extinct each and every day? Did you know that solid scientists are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish in 50 years? And do you know why? And do you know that the world used to be filled with thousands of vibrant human cultures, and the human cultures are being driven extinct at an even faster relative rate than non-human species? And do you know why? The man box is full of women. It's full of passenger pigeons. It's full of whales. It's full of indigenous humans. The man box is full of the entire world. But the man box isn't full, because the man box, which doesn't exist, can never be full. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang famously asked, how do you plug a void plugging a void? That's the question, isn't it? But of course it isn't the question, because men don't have a void. And if they did have a void, they certainly wouldn't plug it with a void. Someone once told me that any hatred, or maybe any void, felt long enough no longer feels like hatred, but rather like religion, or economics, or science, or tradition, or just the way things are. With all the world at stake, I need to speak plainly. The problem is that within this patriarchy, identity itself is based on violation. Violation becomes not merely an action, but an identity. It's who you are, and how you and society define who you are. Within this patriarchy, men's masculinity defines itself by identifying others, any and all others, as inferior, which is why those stupid fucking scientists can ask, are we all alone, as they destroy the extraordinary life on this planet, as being therefore violable and then violating them. For men under this patriarchy, these acts of violating others are how we become who we are. The they validate who we are. They then reaffirm who we are. As through these repeated acts of violation, we come to perceive each new violation as reinforcement, not only of our superiority over this other we violated, but simply the way things are. So without this identification of others as inferior, without this violation, we are not. We're a void. And so we must fill this void, fill it with validations of our superiority, fill it with violations, thus the rapes, thus the violation of every boundary set up by every indigenous culture, thus the extinctions, thus the insane belief in an economic system based on infinite growth despite the fact that we live on a finite planet, thus the refusal to accept any limits on technological progress, more properly termed technological escalation, as it really involves an escalation of the wielder's ability to control and violate the distance, on scientific, quote, knowledge, end quote. Thus the sending of probes to penetrate the deepest folds of the ocean floor. Thus the bombing of the moon. What makes this problem even worse is that because there are always those who have yet to be violated, and because this violation isn't really solving the needs it purports to meet, it's a void plugging the void, the drive to violate is insatiable. The culture will continue to violate until there's nothing left to violate, nothing left. So what's at stake in this whole discussion of life on this planet? This cult of masculinity must not merely be left, and must not merely be exposed, it must be destroyed, or it will continue to violate its way to the end of all that's alive. But before we can leave this cult, we have to understand that it's not all it is, that there is a cult of masculinity, and there's a man box, and you can leave them both. Burn this into your heart. This imperative to violate is not natural. It's cultural. But we must resist every effort by the abusers, by the violators, to naturalize this drive to violate. For this is what abusers, violators, must do. They must attempt to convince themselves and everyone else that their way is the only way. There is no other way. They must convince themselves and everyone else that not only is there nowhere outside the cult of masculinity, nowhere outside the man box, but indeed there exists neither a cult of masculinity nor a man box. There's only this one way of life, which is not just a way of life, because it encompasses all that ever is or was or ever will be. It's everything, they say. But they're lying to themselves and to you. Even if they have an entire culture to back them up, they're still lying. We must never forget that. There's a cult of masculinity, and there's a man box, and we can leave them. We can not only leave them, we can destroy them. We must. With all the world at stake, we must.
So that's cheery. Part of, you know, I mentioned earlier that I saw what I perceived as a gap in discourse and I went to fill it. And part of the gap that I perceived was that I don't fundamentally think that the problems we face are fundamentally rational, I think. And I don't think that therefore they're amenable to rational solution. I think we have an entire culture that is suffering from deep psychoses. And one of the premises of Endgame is that the culture is insane. I think most of the members of it are insane as well. I think we in many ways have to be insane to put up with this shit. I mean, no matter what we're talking about, you know, I'm going to talk about larger scale insanity in a second, but the personal insanity is, and for God's sake, for capitalism's sake, which I guess is the same thing, isn't it? Who is the idiot who came up with the idea of a wage economy? You know? I used to have this habit of asking people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? It's just fucking nuts. And likewise, on a larger scale, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Or how about poisoning groundwater? That's a good idea. Or the global fishing economy is actually subsidized to a value greater than the value of the entire catch. Governments around the world pay more money to the fishing industry than the value of the catch. Should I say it again? And what this means is that we'd all be better off if all the commercial fishermen on the planet were paid to stay at home and sit in their underpants and watch The Price is Right. I mean, it's a crazy, crazy system. And so I find it somewhat ironic when people will suggest sort of, I get this all the time actually, people write to me and say, okay, here's the problem. If we just rationalize the entire economy and make it so everything runs smoothly and make it so, it's like, yeah, or maybe dragons can come and save us. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. You can't, rape is not rational, you know? It's like child abuse is not rational. You can have them make sense. How many people have read the book, Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry Controlling Men by Lundy Bancroft? Oh, good, nobody's right. I can just say it means whatever the hell I want it to there. Yeah, it says Derek Jensen, the best writer I've ever seen. So basically, Lundy Bancroft, it's a very interesting book. He, you know, I'd already written a lot about abuse by that time, by the time I read his book, but he still taught me a lot. And one of the things he taught me is that I always bought into the notion that abusers will lose control. They'll lose their temper. And they'll just start lashing out. But he asked some very important questions, such as, so when abusers lose their temper, do they beat up a policeman? When they destroy things, do they destroy their own stereo? Pretty no. So what he says, the question I always ask is, who gains from any act? When the perpetrators have a very, very clear sense of the social hierarchy, and a very clear sense of only forcing the violence down the hierarchy, which is why abusers will lose their temper, in quotes, with someone below, but they won't do it with someone above, generally. And the same is true with their destruction of things. I think about this in terms of culture. So I'm saying this as sort of a counter-argument to what I just said about the culture being insane. It is insane, but then within its own context, it makes sense. And one of the ways I think about this, and we're going to get back to some point in a moment, one of the ways I think about this is there's a great line about Adolf Hitler, that it was said, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. From insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And I think about that a lot in terms of capitalism. You know, once you accept sort of the premises of capitalism, you're going to be locked into a certain mindset, and it can end up making complete sense to poison your own groundwater to make money. Or actually, it's better if you can poison somebody else's groundwater to make money. And I'm getting way off topic now, whatever the topic is, but I'm working on a book right now about human supremacism. And I think human supremacism is the biggest problem we face today. And once again, if you accept the insane premise that humans are fundamentally superior to and separate from everyone else, then everything else can make sense. But if you start to examine that premise, then everything will start to fall apart. Oh, can I talk about human supremacism for a minute?
Yes.
It's very interesting. How many people have read very much about plant intelligence? Like, oh man, a lot of people. I guess I'm a late comer to this game. There's some extraordinary work being done on it. Okay, first off, do we all know that plants will communicate with each other? Like if a caterpillar starts to eat the leaves of one plant, it will send out communications to other plants to let them know that there's caterpillars here and you need to change the composition of your leaves. And they will do this for other species as well. It's not just themselves. And I just heard, I read the funniest damn thing about that that has to do back with these national premises, which is that there were some scientists who were studying this, and they are, and they're middle-aged white guys, and they are suggesting that the plants aren't actually communicating, but instead they're basically doing soliloquies that other plants might listen in on, and they're doing this because they're asking the question, why would any plant spend energy communicating to its competitors that there is a predator nearby. And, okay, first off, one of the things that scientists always use to nerd bully people into not saying anything about human supremacism is they use the word anthropomorphizing. And they say that if you believe that a non-human perceives or communicates, you're anthropomorphizing. Okay, just a second. Let's talk for a second about middle-aged white guys who are saying that plants aren't actually communicating, but instead they're doing soliloquies just to hear their own voice, and if somebody else gains something from this, that's all the better. It's like, I'm sorry, project much? And second, I just have to say this about anthropomorphization, that they talk all the time about ecosystems, and they talk all the time about selfish genes, and they talk all the time about mechanistic science. I can't think of anything that's more anthropomorphic than to project machine language onto the natural world. That's just nuts. And the reason that's acceptable is because, like, I saw this pretty interesting essay by Michael Pollan about plant intelligence, and he was commenting that a lot of scientists have a much easier time accepting the notion of artificial intelligence than they do plant intelligence. And that's really extraordinary. And Stefano Mancuso says, well, that's because computers are human creations. And so we can accept that a car, that a meter could be a smart meter, and because they're ours, and so they're an extension of us, as opposed to a plant being a smart plant or anything else. And I want to tell you one story about this real quickly, and then we'll move on, which is Monica Gagliano. She did this great experiment. You know mimosa plants? They're those plants that if you touch them, sensitive plants, if you touch them, they fold their leaves up. And they think probably that one reason that they will fold their leaves up is that will then perhaps convince a predator it's a dead plant, so it's not as nutritious, or maybe it exposes less open area. Hey, the point is that for whatever reason, the plant will close up when it gets traumatized. And so she wanted to find out if plants could learn, or really if we could perceive ways they could learn. And what she found is that, so she devised this very interesting experiment where you lift up a plant 15 centimeters, what's that, 7 inches? 6 inches? 8 inches? 15 feet. 15 centimeters. However, you know the metric. You know how many inches that is. So she'd lift them up 15 centimeters, and then she would drop them. And when she would drop them, the plant would get shaken, and it would close up. And so she arranged this experiment where they would lift up the plant, and they would drop it every 30 seconds or so. And she wanted to find out, because the big question on cognition is whether you can tell whether something is scary or whether it is something you can ignore. So if you're walking down the street and you hear an air conditioner in a building, you know, you're going to think, oh, this is an air conditioner in a building. It's not something scary. But if you hear a gunshot, you'll move differently. So the point is that what she found is that when she would drop the mimosa plants, they would close up. But then after, depending on the plant, because some plants learn quicker than others, within 10 to 30 times, they would quit closing. They'd realize this is no big deal. And so then, of course, one of the objections is that can't be learning, but instead the plants were just getting tired. So what she would do is she would touch the plants, and they would still close. And then what she found is she would wait. She thought, okay, I'm going to wait like a week and see what happens and see if they'll still remember. After a week, they still remember. So she waited for a month, and they would still remember whether this is significant. And I just have to be honest here and say, at this point, I have to make a fucking list before I actually leave the house to tell me what to leave. I mean, I can't remember things for 5 minutes, much less a month. And Anyway, so the book I'm working on currently about plant intelligence, I gotta say a little more too, because it's just so fun. I love all the arguments for human superiority because they're all tautological. Tautology is when you use something to define itself. So, like, the first rule of tautology club is the first rule of tautology club. Oh, I guess philosophy jokes don't work here. Tautology work. Maybe my jokes don't work here. Okay, anyway, so using something to define itself. And so it's great. Like, humans are superior because we, we make automobiles. And, well, because we make automobiles, then that means we're superior, because if you're superior, you make automobiles, which means we're superior, which is why we make automobiles. And one of the arguments that I just love is that humans are really smart because of our brain size. That's how we know we're smart, is humans have big brains. And in fact, I just heard somebody say on John Stewart the other night that human brains are the most complex thing in the universe. It's like, dude, narcissism much? So really, human brains are more complex than oceans? Forests? Maybe communities of human brains altogether? Humans are... The only problem with the notion that humans are smarter because of our brain size is that we don't actually have the biggest brains. Walruses' brains are about the same size, a little bit smaller. Elephants, of course, are much bigger. Whales are huge. And, that's the thing. Is the important thing is not actually brain size. The important thing is brain size to body mass ratio. And humans have a just huge brain size to body mass ratio of about 2.5%. And the only problem is, of course, that that's the same as the brain size to body mass ratio of mice. And songbirds are about 8%. Shrews actually have the largest brain size to body mass ratio of any creature. So if you want to make an argument for brain size to body mass ratio meaning superiority, it's fucking shrews. Anyway, so this is all my explanation of ecofeminism. Okay, so we'll go to question two. Progress, what is it to you? Well, to me, real progress would be more wild salmon every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and more ancient forests every year than the year before, and more fish in the oceans every year than the year before. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. I was doing a talk up in Portland several years ago, and one of the people in the audience came up afterwards. And I've been talking what I do quite often, which is about fighting back. And he said, you know, I don't think that it's time to fight back yet. I said, okay, great. I can understand that. I can accept that. So what I'm interested in here is a threshold. So 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. You tell me the point at which it would be acceptable to you to actually work to bring down civilization that's come to planet. Okay, ready? 91%? 92%. 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100. And he said, I guess I would never feel it's okay to fight back. I said, well, okay, I'm glad we're clear. I'll tell you something. I don't know if I've ever actually said this in a talk before, but those of you who have heard my talks before know that I do this thing where I say, give me a threshold, which if I may fight back, and I'll do the numbers on that. You know where I actually got that? I got that from a really great book, a very interesting book, called And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz. It's about the beginnings of the AIDS crisis. And one of the things that the AIDS activists said to the San Francisco City Council, I believe, at one point, was they said, okay, give us a threshold, which you're going to call as an actual epidemic. You know, it's like we've had, I don't know, however many people dying now, 5,000 people? Okay. If it's 6, we call an epidemic. And it's like that line, I mean, the book itself is fabulous. And that line has always really struck me because it's so easy, especially when you are, how many people in here have ever been in an abusive relationship where you were victimized by an abuser? I don't know if you did this, but I have done this in those situations where it's like, okay, next time I'm actually going to resist. Next time I'm going to walk out that door. Next time I'm going to stand up for myself. And I don't know about you, but it doesn't work for me. It's like, what I have needed to do is to set myself some sort of tangible threshold. It's like, I'm not going to cross this line. And that's been very helpful. So that's, I've tried to do that on a large scale. You know, what will it take for us to, and we're going to get this, one of the questions later is, what's the influence of social structure on the natural world? I'm going to talk about that. But well, we'll get there in a minute. I'll go back to this. So progress means to me that more wild salmon, more migratory songbirds, more fish in the oceans. It means less cars. Since humans have overshot, it means less humans. It means especially less industrialized humans. It means at least as many indigenous languages. I know that it takes a long time for a language to develop, but indigenous languages are being driven extinct at an even faster relative rate than non-human species. And on the other hand, when people talk about progress, usually what they mean is technological process, which, like I said before, really should be called technological escalation. And a way to think about that is, and I try to think about this all the time, is what would things feel like from the perspective of a salmon? What would things feel like from the perspective of a wolverine? What would things feel like from the perspective of, oh, speaking of mass delusions, for God's sake, I gotta tell you, I love sports. I really enjoy sports. I love playing them. I love watching them. But I gotta tell you, they fucking break my heart. And the reason they break my heart is because every Michigan Wolverines home football game has been sold out since 1975. And that's 100,000 people at every University of Michigan home football game. There was a Wolverine in Michigan in 2002. It was the first one in 200 years. And what kills me is that more people care about the Michigan Wolverines than care about Wolverines. And more people care about the Detroit Tigers than care about real Tigers. And more people, you know, we can go through the whole list with the Miami Marlins, and more people care about San Diego Padres than real Padres than more. So, anyway, I think I mentioned earlier the importance of premises. And if you can slide your premises by people, you got them. And progress is one of those words. So progress is good, right? You know, making progress towards some goal. But if we talk about technological progress in terms of technological progress, then that leads us to assume that it's an undivided good. But for God's sake, I don't even think email is an undivided good.
No shit.
What, am I the only person here who hates email?
No.
Okay, there's two of us. We should go on fucking club. We can email about this. Anyway, so that's how deeply this violation imperative inheres in this culture, is that we can call the ability to control at a distance, because that's really what technology is here. We're going to get more into this in a minute. We call that progress. Or an even better one, how many people know Richard Dawkins' work? How many people kind of hate Richard Dawkins? It's about half of us. The other half, you're the enemy. Okay, Richard Dawkins has this line. I don't like it. Okay, Richard Dawkins has this line where he talked about science bases its claims to truth. This is a direct quote. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Say it again. Science bases its claims to truth, with me so far, on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And that's kind of true. You know, the reason we know that science is true is because when you turn on a light, when you flip the switch over there, the light goes on. You know, so you are able to make things happen. That's how we know it's true. But it's really, really sneaky. And the reason it's sneaky is because he has conflated the ability to control with how we know something's true. And think about it for a second. Okay, since I'm going to pretend to shoot somebody, Tony. Yeah. Okay, so.
Email.
Okay, so. Pretend I got a gun. Okay? I point it at you. And pretend there's a hoop right next to him. And I say, Tony, on the count of three, you're going to jump through the hoop, or I'm going to shoot you. On the count of three, he jumps through the hoop. What do you know? I'm a fucking genius. because I predicted when he was going to jump through a hoop, and I predicted when. And I made matter and energy jump through a hoop on command. But don't you think that if I point a gun at Tony and tell him, I'm going to shoot you unless you jump through a hoop, don't you think that this might harm our friendship?
He might draw first.
Exactly. I mean, he said, unless you draw first. So the point is that, is it not possible that even in something as simple as Richard Dawkins' straightforward line about science basis claim the truth, that that carries in it some inherent assumptions and also destroys other forms of relationship? That if we are really busy spending all our time making matter and energy jump through some command, which is another way of saying making, enslaving other beings, then don't you think that that might make it so they don't really want to talk to us? You know, maybe that would make it so they don't like us. And maybe, you know, a lot of indigenous people have said to me that non-humans don't go extinct, that instead they're going away because they don't like how they're being treated. And I don't know if I believe that or not, but I can't blame them, you know? It's like, I wouldn't want to stick around either. If it used to be, I don't know about down here, but I know up in what's now Crescent City, that the Talawa have salmon welcoming songs. And I know a lot of peoples along the coast that have salmon welcoming songs. So I like to think about this in terms of technology too. That when we think of technology, we usually think of machines. But why don't we think about technologies as, why would a song not be a form of technology? And what if you have, how different would it be if your progress consists of coming up with better and better salmon welcoming songs? Of course, this means you won't be able to conquer your neighbors quite so well. And that's a problem if your life is based on conquest. We can talk about it or not. Anyway, so progress, what it would mean to me, real progress, would be more wild salmon every year than the year before. As soon as that happens, then I'll feel less progressive. You know, that's another thing. I sometimes get pegged as this real, I don't know, this sort of hardcore dude who wants to bring down civilization. But the truth is, I like hot showers as much as the next person. But the thing is, I can do math. And I can do simple arithmetic. I understand if you have 6 billion passenger pigeons, and then you've got 5 billion, and they got 4 billion, eventually you won't have any. And if you have uncountable salmon, and then you can count them, that's a bad thing. And then if there's even less and less every year, eventually there won't be any. And I can understand that if you have, let's just say there's some number that is, let's say, I don't know, 350. And then 350 goes to 351 and 352, and then it goes to 400. That eventually you're going to end up in hell. And so the point is that part of the reason that I am so convinced that we need to do things dramatically differently is because I can do simple arithmetic. I think progress, here's how deep these things are. Okay, people, I presume half the people in here at least use word processing programs at some point. That's pretty fucked up. And probably more people use word processing programs than, I don't know, sing salmon welcoming songs. No, I don't know, that seems pretty crazy. Anyway, I hate the fact that whenever I try to type in the tree who lives by the pond, that it auto-corrects me to the tree that lives by the pond. It's like, how dare you? Except I just implied that the machine's alive because of that. Anyway, okay, what is the influence of social structure on the natural world? Well, we can say capitalism's killing the planet, you know. So what is the influence of social structure on the natural world? And I want to talk to you about two things. One is agriculture, and then one is Lewis Mumford. And you know, they say that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And the one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh, deforested in the plains and hillsides of Iraq. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? That's what it was prior to the beginnings of this culture. It was heavily forested. And then Gilgamesh went in and cut them down to make great cities. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Those four, you know, the cedars of Lebanon, you know, still have one on their flag. Greece was heavily forested. All of the big philosophers, what, Socrates and Aristotle and those other dead people, they complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And I have absolutely no doubt the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them they need to study this for a few years and make sure there's really a correlation. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests went down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. Italy was forested. Prior to the beginnings of agriculture, there were hippos on the Thames. And what agriculture is taking a plow to the soil, and what that does is convert, it's biotic cleansing. It cleanses the soil down to the level of bacteria, and then it turns it all to human use. And the disadvantage of this, of course, is you're killing where you live. The advantage of it is because you're converting everything to human use, this means that you can have an increased population. But one of the things it does is it also means, we'll give that a second, it also means that you can, it commits yourself to an aggressive lifestyle. Because if you destroy your own land base, you then have a choice. You can either collapse or you can conquer somebody else. The thing is, somebody else lives there. So this is one of the problems we face, and this is one of the problems that indigenous peoples around the world have faced. I mean, the Talwa, I don't know about the people who live here, but the Talwa lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of Talwa, they lived there since the beginning of time. But the point is, they lived there for at least 12,500 years. And the dominant culture has been there for about 180, and the place is now completely trashed compared to what it was. But the point is that the Talwa lived there sustainably. And one of the disadvantages of living sustainably is you're not cutting down the forest to make navies. You're not destroying your land base to make machines of war. And so one of the problems that I don't know how to deal with is the fact that this way of life has created a short-term competitive advantage for the people who live that way at the expense of everybody else. And unfortunately for everybody on the planet, this is not a plan with a future on planet planet. So that was the agriculture part, is that once you've committed yourself to agriculture, you've really committed yourself to an unsustainable way of life. What do we do with that? I think some progress would be recognizing that. And it's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And I had a thing recently. I recently learned, I mean, I have Crohn's disease, as many of you know, and there's sort of a cascading systems failure happening. And because of the Crohn's disease, I got some other problems, and now because of the Crohn's disease also, I've ended up with a heart problem. And the reason I bring all this up is because I've only recently had this diagnosed. And at first, I thought it was heartburn. And I was doing all the things that are supposed to help heartburn, and then nothing was changing. And then I got the diagnosis, and here's how it works. It's like when a metaphor slaps you in the face, before I can see it, once, maybe one time out of ten. And the time I did see it this time was that if you have the wrong diagnosis, it doesn't matter how well you follow the cure. It doesn't do you a bit of, doesn't do you a fucking bit of good. I thought it was kind of profound, but okay, so this is how a writer works too. Is you come up with a metaphor you think's really good, you share it with somebody, and they like stare at you, it's like, fuck it, throw that one away. That was for me, my ticket to Stardom. It's all down the tubes now. It's ruined it for me. Okay, so, like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. So, if we think the problem is the oil economy, yeah, that's a problem. We think that's the whole problem, we're going to end up with crazy solutions like windmills. And if we think the problem is a lack of corporate oversight, which is certainly a problem, then we're going to fix the corporate oversight, and we're still going to find out there's other problems. You know, sort of beaten out to death. Okay, but I want to beat Lewis Mumford to death now, too. Actually, I don't, because I really love Lewis Mumford. There's another part of this whole social thing. How many people in here, and I'm guessing the answer is going to be one, me, how many people have read Lewis Mumford's great short essay on authoritarian democratic tactics? Okay, write this down, it's just fabulous. Lewis Mumford, authoritarian democratic tactics. It's the same deal, that because you haven't read it, I can just say whatever the hell. I was like, yeah, that's what he really said. So Lewis Mumford, he says that you can't just talk about technology. Instead, you have to talk about what he calls a technics, T-E-C-H-N-I-C-S. And a technic is the social circumstances that give rise to and emerge from a certain technology. So why did the Talwa not invent backhoes? It's not because they were too stupid. It's because their social system was set up to create other forms of technology like salmon welcoming stones. And you have to have a certain mindset that will lead to a technology in the first place. And then once you have a technology, you're going to perceive the world differently because of this technology. All I have to say about that is automobiles. I mean, like, how far do you live from the nearest grocery store?
6 or 7 miles or so.
Okay, 6 or 7 miles is how far I live from the nearest grocery store. Okay, let's say you're driving home from the grocery store, but you forgot a really important thing that you need for tonight. It's like, ah, shoot, I gotta go back, right? Now let's pretend, on the other hand, you don't have a car. So you get home from walking 6 or 7 miles to the grocery store, and you forgot to get toilet paper. It's like, oh, fucking hell. You know, it's a bigger deal. So the point is that once you have a technology, it creates a certain mindset that will go with it. And so part of what he talked about, Lewis Mumford, a completely brilliant guy, part of what Mumford talked about was the importance of, or what he said, that we can have various techniques that are democratic or authoritarian. And there's two ways we can go with this. One of them is that one technique might lead to democratic community decision-making processes. Another technique might lead to authoritarianism. And a great example of that would be bows and arrows versus guns. And the difference is that anybody can make a bow and arrow. You might not make it well, but anybody can nap an arrowhead, and they can get a piece of wood. You can make a really crappy one, but you can still make one. On the other hand, if you have a gun, you need metals, which means you need mines. And if you need mines, that means you need the entire infrastructure that goes with the mines. Because how else are you going to get people to work down there? You need slavery, because how else are you going to get people to work underground? Because agriculture and mining were the two of the original slave enslavement areas, because nobody wants to do it, because it's really, really hard work. And so the point is that if you have a gun, also, a gun can be controlled by a distant entity, because if they have access to the mines, then they can control your access even to the bullets. And if they have control of the back guano, they can control your access to gunpowder. Whereas, once again, an arrow, you can make them yourself. Pottery is another example of a democratic technic. Anybody can do it. On the other hand, you can't make a computer in your backyard. You can't do it from materials that grow on trees, which means it is inherently authoritarian because it requires a larger social structure, which means, here's another great example. Passive solar is a great example of a democratic technique because anybody can align your being or your home with the sun. On the other hand, solar photovoltaics require rare earth minerals. They require the entire mining infrastructure. And so once again, when we talk about progress, and we talk about technological progress, what are we talking about? And it ends up that a lot of these are inherently authoritarian, and they require these entire social structures. It's like a lot of anarchists say, I want to do away with the state, I want to do away with cops, I want to do away with this. It's like, great. What are you going to do for metals? Because you have to have the entire global economy at this point to have metals. And you have to have the whole system of cops, military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in order to have those. And so my point is, but it goes even further, because that's basically my interpretation of what Lewis Mumford said, but he's actually saying something I think even more radical, which I actually like, I think even better, which is he thinks that ultimately the authoritarian techniques are not authoritarian because they require authoritarian social structures. He thinks they're authoritarian because they end up running the whole show. The techniques themselves, and we see this all the time, where they talk about the economy has to grow, even though anybody in their right mind recognizes we live on a planet cleaning. But who's in charge? There's a great line by, oh, who's his name? The guy who did the Taylor, Frederick Winslow Taylor. He's the guy who came up with the McDonaldization idea that like you have people do the individual parts, like one person flips burgers all day and then somebody else does a cash register all day. Taylor came up with that. Taylor has this great line, which is, in the past, excuse the sexism, in the past the man was first. In the future, the system shall be first. That's it, right? That's the whole thing right there. That's why capitalism is killing the planet. Because who's in charge? Who's in charge of this? Well, Obama's really in charge of the world. Really, who's in charge of this whole crazy thing? The techniques have gotten away from all of us. And this goes back to the first thing I was talking about, which is the whole culture being insane. I mean, see, there's another thing. Is people have heard of the, what are they called? The singularity people. The people who think that humans are going to merge with machines. I'm sorry?
Cyborgs.
Transhumans, thank you. Yeah, this whole transhuman crowd is just, on one hand, they're scary as hell. And on the other hand, they are behind the times. Because they're talking about how humans are going to be uploaded into machines and we're going to be all inside machines. I got fucking news for you, which has already happened. And what I mean by that is, okay, how many machines are within 15 yards of us? How many wild animals are within 100 yards of us? How many machines do you have a daily relationship with? Car, computer, phone. How many wild animals you got a daily relationship with? That would be zero, probably. I realized with great horror 5 or 6 years ago that I touch plastic more than I touch human flesh. That's a fucking nightmare. It also says a lot about my social life. Be that as it may, the point is we're already inside the machine. And another great thing that Lewis Mumford had is he realized that a machine is not just a piece of equipment, but a machine is also a social structure. And you can have entire societies structured along the lines of a machine where individuals play out as cogs in this machine. And, I mean, is any of this sounding familiar?
It's a campus, man.
I'm sorry?
It's a campus.
It's the campus. It's everywhere. And so, what's the effect of social structures on the natural world? Well, I'm not saying that the effect of social structures destroy the natural world, because the Tall, once again, lived up in what is now Crescent City for 12,500 years at least. It is possible for social structures to reinforce. You know, it's all really simple. It's like, I've been going on and on about all this bullshit for a long time. It's all really simple. Ruth Benedict, people know Ruth Benedict, two of us? Once again, we just make up our own way, what we want them. Okay, so Ruth Benedict was a Soviet fighter in World War II who flew fighter planes and stopped the Nazis all by herself, because we're the only ones who know what she is. So. I wrote Ruth Benedict. Anyway, Ruth Benedict was an anthropologist. And she tried to figure out why it is that some cultures are good, to use her word, and some cultures are not. Why is it that some cultures are basically cooperative, they are basically, people are generally happy, they're not very warlike, they're very peaceful, I guess is the word, people cooperate a lot, and children are treated well, women are treated well. A lot of other cultures, women are treated poorly, children are treated poorly, very warlike, very competitive. Why is it? What's the difference? And what she found is it's not race, it's not house size, it's not wealth or poverty of the people. It's really simple. The good cultures figured out, what she calls synergistic cultures, figured out that humans are both selfish and altruistic.
Oops, sorry, that's the wrong way to say it. Humans are both selfish and social. Because that's the big thing, you know, is conservatives think humans are fundamentally selfish, you know, the whole selfish gene thing, the whole capitalism thing. What a fucking weird idea. The idea that all these people acting selfishly is going to make a bunch of community. Anyway, so the good cultures figured out that humans are both social creatures and also selfish. And the way they dissolve, or what's the word? Collapse is the word. Collapse the dichotomy between selfishness and altruism is by reinforcing behavior that benefits the group as a whole and disallowing behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. They reward behavior, socially reward behavior, through praise, the behavior that benefits the group as a whole, and disallow or disreward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. So, for example, there were some tribes in the Pacific Northwest who would have a shaming pole. It's a pole that somebody would put outside somebody's home that basically says, I'm an asshole. And it all really came down to how a culture would handle wealth. That if it handled wealth through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, then everybody is secure and people cooperate. If, on the other hand, wealth is handled through what she called a funnel system, whereby wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, then everybody's a dog-eat-dog, isn't that a wonderful phrase? Dog-eat-dog world, and everybody's at each other's throats. And that, of course, the latter describes this culture perfectly. And how it works is like, I could give every penny in my wallet to the next homeless person I see, how am I going to pay rent? You know? It doesn't work in this culture. On the other hand, in a functioning, synergistic culture, what happens is, I go out and I catch a bunch of salmon. And then I don't hoard it. I don't keep it to myself. Instead, I give salmon to everybody else. And go, oh my God, Derek, you are so cool. And then tomorrow, is there any vegans in here? Okay, so tomorrow, you go and you get a bunch of, you like go gathering for tofu. And you get a bunch of tofu and you give it to everybody in the community. And we go, and what's your name?
Nina.
Nina? And we go, oh my God, Nina, you are so amazing. And we praise her because she did that. On the other hand, if I kept all the salmon or if you kept all the tofu for yourself, we'd be like, put the shaming pole right there or right here. And so the point is, the reason I can give away all the salmon is because I know tomorrow she can give away all the tofu. And then we will all be hungry. And what we're building is social relationships. We're not building capital. We're building social capital. And how this applies to the natural world is, I believe that the same relationships take place between humans and everybody else. And they take place between salmon and everybody else. You know, how did the world get to be so wild and fecund and beautiful in the first place? By creatures living and dying. You know, it's like, I can prove, you know, we believe that nature, that evolution is based on competition. I can disprove that in one sentence and give me a couple semicolons. And that is, those creatures who survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. So it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the fit, which is how well you fit with your surroundings. Salmon make a forest a better place by their existence. And redwood trees make a forest a better place. See, that's, remember the question earlier about how do, you know, why would some creature, why would some plant help its competitors to survive predators? It's because they understand something these scientists don't understand, which is that a redwood forest is made up of more than redwood trees. And it's made up of alders, and it's made up of blackberries, and huckleberries, and thimbleberries, and salal, and everybody else, including the predators. And they understand that the point of life is not, life is not a game of risk where the point is to conquer everybody else and then put the game away. The point of life is to have long-term, interspecific cooperation and community. And the point of life is to make the world a better place than it was before you were born. I mean, that's really the question I ask, is the world a better place because you were born? I don't mean the social structure. I mean, honestly, people come to me and they say, you know, I'm really glad, you know, your books made me feel better about this, or they made me feel worse about this, where it's like, well, that's great, whatever. But what I really care about is, did the books affect the real world? The real world, by
are there more salmon? Like, I don't know why I'm saying this, but you were telling me earlier that a language older than words helped solidify your decisions to become an activist. And, you know, if it made you feel good or secure or happy, then I guess I'm happy. But insofar as you have then helped to protect salmon, I'm fucking delighted, you know? And that for me is always the bottom line, is are there more wild salmon? And anyway, so, you know, I had a book come out like a year ago that was a Derek Jensen reader. And I guess that means I'm ready for retirement or something. Okay, we'll see in the rearview mirror now, Derek. But it made me, what's the word? It gave me an opportunity to sort of reflect, is what I'm looking for. And as I get older and older, it becomes harder and harder to find those words. It gave me an opportunity to reflect on my career. And I was thinking, you know, in many ways, my career is far more successful than I could ever have dreamed when I was fantasizing when I was 25 about being this writer someday. You know, I didn't know that I'd have 22 books out or however many, and I didn't know that people would actually come here and talk, for God's sake. You know, it's like, it's great. You grew up in San Francisco, and I don't mean to disparage it, so I'm so happy you did. That makes me feel great. But I wouldn't drive up from San Francisco.
Happy I did.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did too, but I wouldn't do it. It's like, I don't know if I'd even go to the fucking mailbox to see me. I don't even know if I'd walk to the mirror. Like, anyway, the point is that, you know, there are ways in which the writing career is really successful. And then also, the fact is that there are less salmon now than there were when I started my career. And there are less migratory songbirds. And there are less roly-polies. I don't know, is that happening down here too at home? When I carry firewood in for my mom at night, I used to brush the roly-polies off. I see maybe a roly-poly every 5 or 10 days now. Daddy long legs, have they collapsed down here too?
No.
Are there a lot of them here? Oh, good. I don't know what's going on at home then. Obviously, they don't like me. Something, because they used to, you know how in the winter they all get together and they get these big masses? Like, have you seen this? No? Yeah? It's the coolest thing. I haven't seen one of those for probably 3 years. I think this winter I've seen 3 daddy long legs as opposed to, not 3 masses, 3 harvestmen. So, in that sense, you know, are there more toxins in the world today than there were when I started working? So my work's a complete fucking failure. You know, in terms of judging it that way. I don't know. It's very, very difficult. And what's even more difficult is tying all this shit together. Okay, I think what we'll do is I'm going to answer one more question, and then I'll read something, and then... No, I'm going to answer 2 more questions, but I'm going to read something. First one is, the state of the world is such that we're all feeling a similar sense of impending destruction. What can we do on a global level to work together to bring about change? And I want to say a couple of things about that. One of them is, my friend John Osborne is really my environmental mentor, and he's the one who got me started in all this a long time ago. And he's always been very clear on why he does the work he does, which is, I love this line, he says, we cannot predict the future. And so if grizzly bears are still around in 10 years, they may be around 100. If they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. If bull trout are still here in 10 years, they may be around 100. But if they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. And so as things become, what he says is, as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to make sure that some doors remain open. I love that. And it's why I'm doing my work, is because, you know, if Pacific tree frogs, there's Pacific tree frogs have been getting hammered up where I live through something called Saprolegnia. Saprolegnia is a mold that's everywhere. It's not like chytrid that is invasive. Saprolegnia is supposed to be there. The problem is that, I noticed about 7 or 8 years ago that the frogs were not nearly as loud as they have been when I first moved there about 14 years ago. And I started looking into it. And I saw that a lot of the little Pacific Tree Frog extracts were getting getting all white and fuzzy and then dying. And what that is, I found out, is saprolegnin. Saprolegnin's normal job in a natural community, I don't say ecosystem because of the machine language thing, in a natural community, its role in a natural community is to clean up the weak, to clean up the ones that are going to die anyway. The problem is that the weakening of the ozone layer allows more UVB in, and the UVB weakens the egg sacs of some frogs and not others. Like the red-legged frogs up there are doing okay, but the tree frogs are getting hammered. I noticed that. 90-95% mortality. So what I started doing, you know, this is another thing, is that people often accuse me of being the violence guy because I say that I want to use any means necessary to stop this culture from killing the planet. But that's, what I mean by any means necessary is any means necessary, which includes wading into the pond every week to bring in frog egg sacs and raise them in my kitchen because UVB doesn't go through glass. And so what I do is every weekend, I mean, it doesn't matter, every weekend, every once a week or so during the season, I get in the pond, collect them, and it's so funny because, I mean, I got to tell you, this is a real sacrifice for me because one of my earliest memories is when I was about 5 or 6 years old at the YMCA crying because I hate cold water. So, and this also shows my stupidity because it was 3 years of doing this, basically torturing myself by getting in more detail than you want, but through just below my testicles. And part of the reason I get is because it's cold, but the other is because I've seen these things called toe biters. They're also called giant water bugs. They're large enough, their pinchers are like this big. They're not called toe biters for obvious reasons. But what they do is they snatch somebody, small birds even, and then they will suck the insides out, liquefy the insides and suck them out. And so you can see why I did not get in up to my testicles. I'm willing to sacrifice toes for frogs, but I draw the line. But here's how stupid I am, too, is I was doing this for 3 years, even though I fucking hate cold water, before the word waiter occurred to me. Oh, I got to tell you this, too. Last Saturday or Sunday, I was in the pond, and it was so funny, because I'm just cruising around thinking, wow, this is so great. I love being able to be nice and toasty inside this cold pond, and I'm just moving around. I love how secure my footing is, and you know exactly where this is going. Literally, one step later, and there's nothing like feeling the water rush into a wave, a gap. So the point is, what I've been doing for the last several years is I bring the Pacific tree frog egg sacs in, as soon as they hatch, I put them back out. And I do this because, you know, I love the phrase, not on my watch. You know, the Pacific tree frogs are not going to disappear from this pond on my watch. I wish the rough skin newts have been getting hammered too, but I can't, they're getting hit by chytrid, and I can't save them. I don't know how to do it. But what I can do is I can save these tree frogs. And if they're alive in 10 years, they may be alive in 100. If they're gone in 10, then they're gone forever, at least locally. So that's why, you know, what can we do on a global level? I think one of the things we can do is we can dig in and we can find the things we love and we can say, I'm not going to let this creature go down on my watch. And we can do whatever it takes, including getting in right up almost to your testicles. And there's an additional part, too, that is in addition, environmentalists are just, I've realized this forever, but grassroots activists are hanging on by our fingernails. We're just basically, most of us at least, we're just hoping and praying that this or that creature hangs on until civilization comes down. And it is not sufficient for me to make sure, to try to make it so a few more generations of lynx or bobcat or wolverine, you know, live unharried lives before ultimately they're exterminated. I think it's really time also that we go on the offensive and that we stop this insanity. This is a whole topic for a whole another night, but some of us need to play defensive warfare, and I have nothing but respect for all the activists who are protecting various pieces of ground or various creatures or plants or whomever. And in addition, I would love for us to start taking the offensive to actually, war has been declared in the natural world, and the way you win wars is by destroying the enemy's capacity to fight. And the way that's always been done, including World War II, there were two things that won World War II for the Allies. One is Russians and the Russian winter, and the other is the Allied bombing campaigns that destroyed the Axis' capacity to wage war. And the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta in Nigeria, they have at times been able to reduce oil output by up to 70%. And this is a few hundred people. And I guarantee that when they started, they had fewer resources than probably many of the individuals in this room. And what they did have is a coherent strategy of going after making decisive strikes against infrastructure. So this is a topic that I'm just dropping. I'm just saying it. It's a topic for a whole other conversation, which is the same conversation, really. And the other thing I want to say before I go to the final question is the smartest thing I've ever done in my life is when I was about 27. The big distinction is not between those who believe in military resistance and those who do not. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. If there were enough of us, we could shut down this whole party tomorrow. I think often the French strikes in 2010, they were able to shut down the economy. How? They did something that was much smarter than Occupy. Very great line about Occupy by Jeremy Scahill. He said it had a great first act and no second act. I completely agree. And that's one of the problems if you... It's a whole other topic. Anyway, the point is, if you don't think strategically, you can't have a second act. And one of the things that the French did during the strike is they didn't just occupy places, they occupied strategic places. They thought like a military. And they would, for example, blockade the oil terminals. Now you're talking. You know, it's like, if you want to have an effect on the economy, black blood, that's the place to go. And so what I want is for people to, well, what I want eventually is for people to think strategically and to start thinking and to recognize. I mean, so many indigenous people have said to me, the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of what that suggests to me is we have to understand that civilization is not an inherent good. The civilization is based on, as Stanley Diamond wrote, civilization originates in conquest abroad and oppression at home. We have to understand these are inherent problems in the system. It's not the system functioning poorly. This is how the system functions. And we have to understand that the Earth is our only home. And the astronomers can talk about all these other planets they're finding. It doesn't make a fucking bit of difference. Because this is our home. And this is where we live. And when you have one planet, and when that one planet is being destroyed, you have enough phytoplankton populations are collapsing right now. And when phytoplankton provides the oxygen for 2 out of every 3 animal breasts on the planet. When the phytoplankton goes down, everybody goes down. And I don't understand. You know, I read this thing years ago where this guy said, this person said, that if there were some sort of forces in war were spreading endocrine disruptors all over the world, we would be running around screaming. But the truth is, they have been spreading endocrine disruptors all over the world, and we aren't running around screaming. One of the ways I put this is if space aliens came down from outer space, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space, and they were systematically deforesting the planet, and they were changing the climate, and they were putting carcinogens in every mother's breast milk, and they were putting endocrine disruptors into everybody, we would know exactly what to do. We would grab our camel outfits, we'd grab our AK-47s, we would have... Wrong audience. I have to tell you, I was doing a talk in Western Pennsylvania, and I came to that line, and they're like, hell yeah! Wait, sorry, am I the only person here with an AK-47? I shared the stage once with Ward Churchill, and he's out in the audience during my talk, and I got to the point where I asked, am I the only person here with an AK-47? The whole place is silent, and then I hear this one voice go, nope. Anyway, the smartest thing I ever did. So the distinction is not between those who think that it will require militant resistance and those who don't. The distinction is between those who do nothing and those who do something. The smartest thing I ever did was when I was maybe 26 or 27. I knew everything was messed up. I knew things were really bad and they're getting worse. And I also didn't know what to do. So what the hell am I going to do? The problem's too big, I can't do anything. So I didn't do anything, of course. And then one day I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. And to cover the, you know, 1980s. And to cover the social and ecological costs. So what I would do, I realized, is I'm going to, every time I spend $10 on gas, I'm either going to give $10 to a local environmental organization, who are always starved for money, or, since I didn't have any money myself, I'm going to pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. Smartest thing I ever did, because it's doable. At that point, it would cost me $10 to fill a tank of gas, and so if I filled it once a week, I would do 2 hours of activism. I started by writing letters to the editor, which I was so scared that I did this under fake names. It's like, how times have changed. So my point is, don't let cowardice get in your way, because it can certainly get my way. And then after that, I went to anti-fur demos and anti-circus demos. And another thing, don't let ignorance get in the way either. God knows I'm a male, and so I'm allowed to not let ignorance get in my way. I went to this anti-circus demo, and they gave me signs. I didn't make a sign. They gave me a sign, standing up holding a sign, and somebody said, came up to me and said, so what's wrong with circus? It's like, I don't know. I just did it bad, you know? And then, okay, so I did that, and then I went from there to timber sale appeals. And then, you know, from there. And by then, I quit keeping track, because I was having so much fun doing the activism that, you know, I was like, I could buy myself a whole fucking tanker, you know? And so the point is, do something, you know? It's like, I disagree with many of the premises of the protesters here, but I gotta tell you, I am so glad to see people who are actually doing something. It makes me so fucking happy. Even if it's against me, it's like, well, whatever. I'm still really glad that you're doing something. And we need more people to do things. And then the last thing I want to say. Oh, I already kind of the last thing, which is, what does expanded civilization look like? What are the first steps? And the first step is decolonizing, you know, to decolonize our mind, hearts and minds. But change has to happen in the real world too, and not just our attitudes. You know, we need to change more than our attitudes. We actually have to change. I don't believe, especially because I think that this culture is crazy, I don't believe that change occurs primarily through education. I think change primarily occurs through changing the institutions, or demolishing them if necessary, but changing the institutions that around which society is organized. So, for example, the Irish, what they had to do first is drive the British out of their minds. That's why the Gaelic literature revival was so important. And then once they did that, and once they broke that identification with the British, then they got to drive the fucking British out. And it's the same with the Indians. This is where Gandhi was really, one of the ways Gandhi was really brilliant, is by showing we need to have an Indian identity. That's the first step toward revolution. And then after that, you know, he was peaceful, the Sikhs weren't, you know, we can take our pick on that. But the important thing, I think, is to separate. And it's the same here. We got to separate from the dominant culture. It's like we always hear, you know, like we hear some TV person say, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Well, there's a bunch of premises there. First off, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Second off, we want the U.S. economy to exist. And third, who the hell's we? You know? It's like, people will say, oh my God, our president. He's not my fucking president. He's the president of the United States. There's a difference. I'm not the United States. It's like, you know, a friend of mine called me up and said, so it's great, we're going to leave Afghanistan. And I said, I thought we're Northern California. My friend said, it's great our troops are leaving Afghanistan. I said, we got troops? Do you want to call them? He's like, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. So I think the first thing we need to do is to break our identity with the system. Oh, it's like George Monbiot wrote this crazy fucking article a while back, right after Fukushima. He said, well, Fukushima's no problem at all. Anyway, right after Fukushima, he said that Fukushima reinforced his understanding of the importance of nuclear energy. Anyway, one of the things he said is, nuclear energy is really important because how else are we going to get the energy to run our factories? Let's change a couple words and see how this reads. How else are the capitalists going to get the energy to run their factories? It changes everything. So the first thing we have to do is separate from the system and recognize the system is not our friend. That doesn't mean that we need to not have Obamacare. It doesn't mean that we need to not use electricity, because that's not the important thing. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down those systems of oppressive authority. And so that's what we need to do. That's the next step. The first step is separate. The second step is do something about it. Okay, so what I'm going to do to end is, it is customary when speaking of the apocalypse to end on a happy note. But I can't quite do that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the most beautiful thing I've ever written. And I didn't actually write it. It was written by a stream near my home, by which I don't mean that I wrote it sitting by the stream. I mean that the stream wrote it. I was trying to write a piece about, I think the most important question in relationships is, what is it like to be you? I think that's a desperately important question. I don't think we ask each other. We don't ask our lovers. We don't ask our friends. We don't ask our parents, our children. We don't ask the trees outside our home. And I think it's a hugely important question. What's it like to be you? And so I was trying to write what it's like to be a river. And then I realized how incredibly stupid this is when I actually live right next to a river, and instead of me writing it, I can just go ask the stream. So I went down to the stream and I said, what's it like to be you? And the stream had been waiting so long for someone to ask this question, for a human to ask this question. And it gave me the answer right away. And I'm running back in the house to write it down. I'm running through the forest, and the forest is going, hello, what's it like to be me? So this is what they said to me. And then this is how I learned.
Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more in pools and rivers and move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You are the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You are the pressure who pushes water through seams. You are the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You are the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river whose all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees and the meadows you flood and feed and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forest. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks through the trees and the trees who speak through the wind. You are the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You are the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die.